Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Winner's Edge with Ray Pelletier, America's business attitude coach and founder of the January 1st Permission to Win Philosophies. Boy, have we got something special for you today. In the business world and the sports world, only a handful of people ever impact in such a way that their name becomes a household word. Edison, Bell, Ford, Disney, The Babe, Stan the Man, Say Hey, Mickey, Michael, Dr. J. Well, in this edition of The Winner's Edge, Ray goes one-on-one with Reggie. Mr. October, Reggie Jackson. Candid, directed, from the heart. This is the opportunity for you and your team to hear what it takes to hit the big slot, to be the go-to guy or gal in your organization, Mr. Clutch. You'll never hear Reggie more candid and honest, so crank up the car stereo, kick on the headphones. It's Ray and Reggie bringing you The Winner's Edge. We're in Newport Beach, California. This is Mick Rizzo with Ray Pelletier, America's business attitude coach. Hey, Ray.
Hey, Mick. How you doing?
I'm doing incredible. This is a fantastic day. We got so much going on today. Ray, right out of the box, tell me about the book.
Hey, I'm psyched. It's finally here. It took me 18 years to get it done. It's out. In fact, in 9 business days, it became a business bestseller in just 9 days. It blew us away. We're absolutely shocked. In fact, one client, GTE, the president, Tom White, ordered 63,000 copies of the book in paperback for them, and it's just absolutely amazing.
What printed edition are you in already?
Well, it's really unusual because our initial run, we're just about to go ahead and say we need another edition to be printed right now, and also we did a special edition for GTE in paperback for them, and it's just absolutely amazing. In fact, flying here last night, ran into a client of mine on the airplane flying in from Chicago, and I spoke for them last February. And what they ended up doing is, on the airplane, he ordered 1,000 copies, and he's going to send them in the beginning of the year for everybody on his team.
Your corporate clients have been asking for this book for a long time.
It's really amazing to me because although people have been asking for the book, I don't think that I had that sense that people were really crying for the message, and that's the neat part. In fact, one of our friends from a company called Catalink Direct told us that she's now reading it to her 5-year-old son, so that's pretty neat.
Tell us the story about the 5-year-old because that was really fascinating. Well, and it blends into The Winner's Edge.
The Winner's Edge tape is making a positive difference in people's lives, but I was kind of blown away to find out that this mom, in order to distract her son, decided that she'd put him in the room and, for just to humor him, put on the tape. So at family events, what ends up happening is instead of the kids coming out and reciting nursery tales or nursery rhymes, the child comes out and repeats vignettes from the tape and actually can tell a lot of the vignettes right now.
Little Raymond, that's kind of scary.
And so I recently spoke there, and I autographed a copy of the book to her son, and now she's reading it to him. So I thought that's kind of neat.
Here's the pitch to Reggie. Swung on, and there it goes. This is number 500, and watch him score. Goodbye, a home run for Reggie Jackson, number 500.
Ray, I know in your 18-year career you've dealt with presidents, all kinds of government figures, sports celebrities, movie celebrities. Tell us about today's guest.
Well, I'm absolutely delighted that our listeners are going to be able to hear today from a baseball legend, from somebody who's made it to the Hall of Fame, who, when we just mention his first name, everybody's going to know who we're talking about. He's known as being a winner. In fact, you can use one name and say Reggie, or you can use two names and say Mr. October. He is Vice President, New Business Development for Viking Components. Welcome, Reggie. Glad you're here.
Thanks, Ray.
I understand you grew up in Pennsylvania. Where'd you start out? Tell us about Reggie early days.
I was from a small middle-class neighborhood in Pennsylvania, predominantly a white neighborhood. I was raised in the early 50s and late 40s, and at the time you were colored. You know, I was from a mixed background. My father was German, black, and Spanish, and raised by a Jewish man. It was a tailor, and we serviced predominantly the white community for, you know, tailoring and dry cleaning. I was an athlete as a youngster, and from a real close-knit neighborhood of Irish, white, Italian, Jewish, that was all very sectarian at the time, and pretty much still is in the East. That's just kind of the way of life back there. You know, had a very good time in school. I was a good student, never missed class or school. And in my 12 years or 13 years of schooling through high school, I was probably absent 8 or 10 days You just weren't allowed to be absent.
A relationship with your mom?
I didn't really have a relationship with my mom as a child. My parents were split when I was 6 years old.
And who raised you?
I was raised by my dad and my oldest brother by the name of Joe.
Can you remember the very first time you picked up a baseball or played baseball for the first time?
Not really. Played in my backyard. My backyard was right, you know, in my dad's shop. The house and the shop were one. We played in the backyard, and our yard was kind of the neighborhood playground for baseball.
How old were you about this time? How old?
6, 7 years old.
Wow.
Playing baseball. And I played Little League at 10, 12, 13. I was a dominant player as a Little Leaguer. I was a pitcher. I played Babe Ruth, and I played what they call American Legion, which was Pony League. And, of course, played junior high. 7th, 8th, 9th grade, and then 10th, 11th, 12th played also.
Let's go all the way back to Little League. What can you remember about Little League?
I was a dominant baseball player. I was a pitcher, first baseman. I did not play in the outfield at all.
How'd you hit the ball?
And I hit the ball just like I hit it when I was a big leaguer, further than anybody and harder than anybody. You know, I hit the home runs, and at that time there were no fences. You just hit it where it stopped rolling.
And who were the most significant coaches early in your life? Who were the people that you'd say coached you in your life? Not even baseball.
Yeah, my father was pretty much the strongest influence on me. I had a good fella in elementary school by the name of Mr. Trimble, who was a physical education teacher. Bob Trimble wound up being the high school physical education teacher. And he was real good with me. He was a good guiding light, if you will. But my father was a very strong force, a hardworking man.
And what was the thing you liked absolutely the most about your dad? You liked the most about him?
He was a hard worker, get the job done, make something happen, had food on the table every night, had electric paid and bills caught up and, food in the refrigerator.
What ticked you off? How did he bug you?
He was maybe a little sloppy. He didn't really tick me off that much. He demanded a lot, and he was my father. I was, 10, 12 years old, 16. He didn't tick me off, When I got a little older, he may tick me off because he was hard on you.
Mm-hmm.
His tongue lashings were rough. You know, I'd have rather got a whooping from him with a strap, really, rather than got some of his tongue lashings became almost unbearable as I got older. But as a child, there was nothing really that he did. I didn't know any different.
Do you think it was more inside of you to prove?
I would say a little bit, Ray, but, it wasn't a driving force. My father really was a driving force.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was told that as a black child, as a colored child, that you need to clearly outdistance the field. You're not going to win any contest with a tie or just being a step ahead in a photo finish.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to clearly outdistance in a 100-yard dash, be able to turn around backwards and look at the opposition. A photo finish or a tie, and you are not going to be the victor.
Mm-hmm.
And, I wasn't bitter about it. I didn't really look for equal opportunity. I, of course, wanted a chance to participate. And if I could participate, I had a greater need. I was hungrier. And in order to get the brass ring, I had to get the brass ring in order to eat.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't, and the white kid at the time had to get the brass ring in order to have something extra. But for me, the light wasn't going to be on at night when I couldn't get no heat in my house if I didn't win, clearly. And so it was a different need for me to be successful, and I didn't have my color cluttering any kind of negative thoughts.
When was the first time that you were ever scouted or you knew that you were being watched with the potentials of making it to the majors?
I was 11 years old.
You're kidding.
And a scout that worked for the San Francisco Giants by the name of Chick Genovese, who signed Willie Mays. A couple of scouts had watched me throw at a young age, and you could see really at the age of 11, 12 years old that I had what they call cat-like moves. smooth, soft, with grace. And a guy gave me his car, and I took it home, gave it to my dad, and I was all excited. He was a scout, and it had a Giants logo on it, and it was a big thing for me.
Who were your baseball heroes then?
Well, as a black child, you had to root for Jackie Robinson because Jackie was the first black man to be involved. And you really didn't know much about the American League because they didn't have blacks in the league at that time. 2 years later, Larry Doby played for Cleveland. And I rooted for the Dodgers. I didn't know about the Phillies because I lived in Philadelphia. I was on the outskirts of Philadelphia. My favorite player was Willie Mays because he was very stylish and smooth and enormously gifted. And I liked the way he ran and threw the ball and things like that. And I didn't really tell very many people, but I also was a big fan of Duke Snyder. But he was white, and, you know, you really couldn't tell a lot of people that as a black child. But he was always one of my favorites, the Duke from Flatbush.
And at what point were you in high school when they actually signed you, or at what point were you signed by a ball club?
I left high school on a football scholarship. I went to Arizona State. I could have gone to Notre Dame in Southern California. I could have been one of the first black kids to go to Oklahoma. I could have gone to Alabama, and I had a chance to go to Duke, but I was going to be the first black to go there, and I was afraid. Paul Bear Bryant had called our house and told us that I was really just the type that they needed to break the color barrier because I was a fair complexion and obviously of mixed descent, and I had great mixed background and had great talent. And I had size. I was a 205, six-pounder when I was a high schooler and just out of high school. And he had, in all the compliments he could say, he said I was just the type of nigger boy that they needed.
Oh, man.
And he didn't mean it in a bad way.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember when he said that to me, I felt proud that he had said that. And I was very close, became a very close friend of Bear Bryant. He was very close with the Yankees and George Steinbrenner. And whenever he would come see the Yankees when I was there, he would always pay homage and go out of his way to say hello. But he never meant any
malice.
A disparaging. It was not a disparaging remark, and I didn't take it that way. Of course, that was in the 60s,
right.
And I never have felt any discomfort. I've always thought of Bear Bryant as a huge Reggie fan, and it paid me a wonderful compliment as a human being, and he addressed me as a nigger boy.
Now, how about recruiters coming? Did they actually come to your house in those days, or how were you recruited by Arizona?
I was recruited by Arizona State, a gentleman by the name of Frank Cush, who's still well-known. He owns Arizona Boys, or is involved in Arizona Boys Ranch, and is a tremendous philanthropic man now, giving back to the community for young people. He was known as probably the toughest and most difficult college coach in the nation, that if you could play for him, then you were a real man or had an opportunity to be a real athlete. I didn't really know it at the time that he was a man-eater. When I went to school there, I was thought of as one of the high, you know, the best athletes really in the country. And he proceeded just to beat the living hell out of me with different tests and things that he put me through.
Appropriate coaching or not?
Oh, at the time, it was. I didn't have a problem with it. Cried at times and sometimes couldn't take it, ran off the field, wanted to quit. But it was kind of the breaking of a little snot-nosed kid into becoming a man. He wanted to see if I could stand the test of being someone to count on.
And tell me about your football career there. Did you play baseball there as well?
I played baseball there. I played baseball really to get out of spring football practice. But I was a football player. They'd never had any people of color on the baseball team. There'd never been a black kid on the team. And a couple of guys that lived in the athlete's dorm bet me that I couldn't make the team. And I didn't really know what I was up against. And I went out one day after football practice and asked if I could take a couple swings. I took my football pads off, my helmet and my shoulder pads, and just had a T-shirt and had football pants and spikes on, and hit a couple balls over the fence. Guy bet me $5. I couldn't make the team. I went to get that $5. Bobby Winkles asked me if I would come back and want to go through some practice, and he asked Frank Cush if he could have permission. Cush said if I maintain a B average, a 3.0 average, that, you know, I could play on a baseball team. The rest of it really is history. Now, when I went to college, I had a counselor by the name of Bill Kajikawa, who was a freshman football coach and physical education administrator. I was a biology major. I spent a lot of time with him, and what I needed, just got it done. There were some tough people, teachers and professors that I had in college. A guy named Mr. Greer, another couple of teachers that were rough. It was tough. Tough on the grades if you missed class. As an athlete, you know, they'd knock you down. Can't think of this one guy's name, but he was rough. He was tough. He had a lot of snide comments and sarcasm, and I kind of liked to hear him get on somebody and get on someone's case. And so I just paid attention because I didn't want him getting on me.
Yeah. I kind of know the answer to this question already.
Dr. Bryant.
There you go.
Dr. Bryant.
You can feel it.
Ooh, Dr. Bryant. He would get on your case so bad and make some girls cry. There was a guy named Mr. Greer. He would catch some guys cheating, and he would wait till class was over, 2-hour exam or 3 hours. He'd wait till everything was done, and he'd say, "Well, Mr. Jones, there's really no sense in you turning your paper in because I've been watching you read off Reggie's paper all day. So I'll ask Reggie what he wants me to give you." He was tough.
Now, I know the answer to this question. You probably could have played professional football or baseball. What was the turning point? How did you – what made the crossroad to go to baseball?
I didn't have a choice, really.
Oh, you didn't?
No, there was I was a second pick in the nation in 1966. So I was drafted by the Kansas City A's by a Renegade owner by the name of Charlie Finley. We needed the money. My father was doing 6 months in prison for writing numbers and bootlegging whiskey. When I got drafted, you know, my father had gotten out of prison, and he was working.
Let me go back to your dad going into prison first. Did that devastate you at the time?
Oh,
how
yeah.
did you handle it?
I was ashamed.
Yeah.
I was really embarrassed because all the kids in school knew it. There was no one at home except my oldest brother, my second brother, who was 2 years older than I. And then when I went to Arizona State, you know, I had to leave school to get the money.
Mm-hmm.
We needed the money.
What year were you?
I was a sophomore.
Sophomore. So tell me about the signing experience, signing your first Major League Baseball contract. Was
my dad was there, and, you know, we were poor. We got flown to Chicago and on an airplane, first time and everything. We went over to his office, and he offered us $75,000 in a new car, a new Pontiac. My dad and I were by ourselves. We rode over to his farm in a private little one-engine airplane, and we rode across a lake and went in the heat. He was going to feed us breakfast and talk about signing the contract. They had eggs and pork chops and cantaloupe and sausage and bacon and eggplant and pancakes and just all this food that we had never really seen before. And they brought a cantaloupe with ice cream in the middle of it. I'd never heard or seen that before. Cantaloupe a la mode. And I ate so much food. Then he offered us a $75,000 and a new car. Emma Fowler and I went and talked, and, you know, he was making $150 a week.
Yeah.
He had been sending me $5 a week in school. My dad and I talked, and I had a couple more years of college to go.
Now, there was no agents in those days?
No, they didn't have
no. So no way to get, I mean, there was nobody to counsel you guys or give you?
No, we no. didn't know. We
great.
$75,000.
Yeah. It's all the money in the world, yeah.
And my dad said, "Could you pay for Reggie's education?" And I want him to go to school because if this doesn't work out, I want him to have something to fall back on. Finley said he would give me $2,000 for every semester of school I would go to. And that was a plenty. I signed my contract for, I think it was $85,000. A new car and $2,000 for every semester of school I went to. He also promised that if I would invest any money with him, that I would only get the profits and never lose.
Hmm.
We did that, and we left, and then they helped us out because we didn't really know how to take the money, so we took the money half of it in 1996 and the other half in 97 for tax purposes.
I'm sorry, half
1966 and the other half in 67.
So now you've signed the contract, and what happens in your life?
Nothing, really. You know, I paid some of my dad's bills, and he didn't really want any of the money. And
but did you instantly go to the club, or did you go to the farm system?
I waited around about a week, and I went to a small town in Lewiston, Idaho, where a lot of the new signees and kids my age have gone. And I went up there for about 10 days, and I was too far ahead of the league. I went from Idaho, Lewiston, Idaho.
How many other black kids?
Oh, there wasn't any.
None. Any hotel problems and those things?
Yeah, I was had a little troubles. I got hit in the head, and I had trouble going into a hospital.
No.
And there was an old man there, our pitching coach by the name of Bill Posedale, and he was a minor league roving pitching coach. And I was really the number one prospect in baseball in the minor leagues at that time. I was big, strong, with a lot of speed. You know, everybody knew about when Reggie Jackson had signed, and they said I'd look like a blacksmith with my size, and he was a guy who was going to play baseball.
How'd the players treat you?
Oh, fine.
Yeah, you know, no problem there.
Fine, yeah. I went there. I went down to Modesto, California, and I played down there with Joe Rudy and Dave Duncan and Raleigh Fingers and some of the guys I went to the big leagues with. I became the best player in that league. Shortly after a couple of weeks, and I developed a tremendous relationships there with Joe Rudy and Dave Duncan. And then the next year, I played in Lewiston, Idaho for about 10 days to 2 weeks, and went down to Modesto, California, and played there for about 59 games, drove in 60 runs and hit 23 home runs. The next year, I played in Birmingham, Alabama.
Oh, boy.
And I got sent to spring training at a place called Waycross, Georgia. And I was scared. I was afraid to go. Wasn't really allowed as a black kid. You really couldn't go into town in Waycross. Camp was about 15 miles outside of town, and they recommended you not to go into town if you were black. So we stayed around on the grounds. I found out that Charlie Finley was from Birmingham, and he was going to send his best players and kids not to AAA but to Birmingham. I was scared to death. They asked me would I go, and I didn't participate in any of the games or anything in spring training in Waycross because I didn't want to go. And I called home and talked to my dad and talked to my oldest brother and all that stuff. And finally I went down to Birmingham. My father went down with me for the first couple of days, and I couldn't find a place to stay. So I slept in Joe Rudy's place, he and his wife, a couple nights a week, and then I went over and slept at Dave Duncan's house a couple of nights a week. And then we had a player on the team named Lee Myers and Mamie Van Doren's husband, an old famous actress.
Hmm.
I spent a couple nights with them and then spent a couple nights with Raleigh Fingers. Finally, they threatened to throw them out if I didn't get a place of my own.
How did blacks treat you then?
Fine. Blacks were very nice, you know, very proud. Very proud of me. That really was the first place the second place I met Bear Bryant.
When did you get called to the big club?
I got called to the big leagues in June of 1967. I was in Birmingham, Alabama, and burning up the league, and you know, the number one prospect really in the minor leagues. And so Charlie Finley called me up after being in Birmingham for about a month and a half. I went up to the big leagues in June of 67.
What was your relationship with Finley through all this time?
It was very good. He looked at me like a son.
Really?
And took care of me and helped me. Charlie Finley was very tough. He looked at all his players as his kids.
Hmm.
A plantation owner type mentality, if you will, but it was in a good way. Well before the Steinbrenners and Jerry Joneses and that type of mentality.
So to say he really loved his players is true.
I think that he really did love his players until the money got big, mm-hmm. and agents got involved, and he soured on the game.
Can you remember that first game, like walking onto the field? I mean, is it as magical as you had imagined?
Yes, I was excited to see a big league clubhouse, to see big league players, to see the uniforms hanging in your locker, see brand new sanitaries and socks and
mm-hmm.
food all around.
One of the first questions I wanted to ask, one of the all-time great teams in Major League Baseball were the Oakland A's, the World Championship teams, three world champions, five divisions. I've heard you say that the 1974 team was probably the all-time greatest team that you ever worked with. Can you give us some thoughts about that team and the energy and the synergy that was part of that team?
We had been together a long time, and each guy knew the other fella so well because we had played in the minor leagues together for a few years, you know, some of us only a few months. But, you know, with Rudy and Duncan and Fingers and Bando and Mundy and Odom and all the fellas that were there, each player had a role. We were very young and in need of each other and each other's need of each other's emotional support. We depended upon each other. You know, we had gone into big cities together, and none of us really were from a big city or was from a big city. And so the fact that we had a need to depend and look for support from each other as we grown older as professionals from the age of 20 when we started. I was in the big leagues when I was 20, and to being 26, 27, 28, as a family, if you will, we really knew what to expect from each other during a ball game, where that person would be defensively during a particular play, whether a ball was hit in the alley. The right-hand pitchers knew who they needed to get out. The bullpen guys, or the relievers, knew their job and their function. I knew what my job was to be as left-hand power. Bando knew what he was supposed to do as the captain and the RBI guy. Rudy knew what he was supposed to do with his impeccable ability of playing with excellence and mistake-free. And so we were a fabulous unit that was just a contiguous unit that fed on each other.
Would you agree with my previous statement that that was probably the finest-tuned team you were with?
I would say yes. It probably wasn't the most talented team. When I went with the Yankees in 1978, we had Rich Gossage and Munson, Hunter and Guidry, and Nettles, and we had just enormous talent, enormous stars in every position. We had so much talent that you just couldn't beat us. With Oakland, I believe it was a better team. We were tighter knit. Each part was dependent more upon the other, and those parts meshed so well, the combination was so good, that our degree of efficiency was higher, even though the Yankees of 78, 77, 78 had greater ability.
How important was the coach?
The coach was enormously important because he knew when to stay out. He knew to constantly play the hand that he had and never really to draw to that hand in any area or in any arena. With the Yankees, we had a manager by the name of Billy Martin who had to have his input, his stamp of approval on it. And at times, that didn't make for the highest efficiency. Whereas in Oakland, we had a manager in 74 by the name of Alvin Dark, who was kind of a laid-back guy that didn't really get involved as much and really let us play. While Dick Williams was a great manager in 72 and 73, the team in 74 was a team that was really the best, most efficient team between 73 and 74. One of those teams was the best team that I was ever on.
Alvin Dark gave you the philosophy that less is better. Less, he just let you do your thing because he knew you could do what you could do.
I don't think that Alvin Dark gave us that philosophy. I think that that was Alvin Dark's personality. You know, he was hired by Charlie Finley, and really because he could be controlled by Charlie Finley. But Alvin Dark was at a point in his career where he was a laid-back fella. He had some problems managing black players and Latin players early in his career, and it was an opportunity for him to express himself as a good guy, as a solid citizen, and a good human being. He had gotten very much involved with Christianity and Christ, and he wanted to express to people that he was a good person. And I think that the timing in his life helped make him a good manager. We just needed someone really to write the names down in the lineup and pretty much let us play. We were very professional, enormously efficient, very respectful of the game and respectful of management, respectful of the fans. It was a different style of a game, and players had a different approach to the game. And for modern-day people, I would say it was very Jordan-like, Pippen, Michael Jordan-like, just a highly efficient, highly tuned, very respectful, professional approach.
You mentioned Dick Williams. What kind of management style? What were some positives, some negatives, working under Dick Williams?
Dick Williams was the number one fundamentalist that I ever played for. To play the game with efficiency, to play the game as a professional, and to play to win, and to do the little things that were necessary, and doing the kind of things that produce victories was what Dick Williams was all about. It came for me at a time in my career that was very important because I was right around 26, 27. I'd been in the league 5, 6, 7 years. I was a star, and I thought I was a superstar, but I wasn't. And I needed someone really to explain to me how to go about being a professional baseball player and how to play to win. And those two things are enormously important. They say an awful lot. Being a professional is being responsible. It's making the sacrifices that are necessary. It's having discipline. It's recognizing that you're just a spoke in the wheel. And many people get those things out of whack. They forget that they're part of something.
It sounds like you've taken those back to basic skills that Dick Williams gave you and put them into corporate America now.
Those are things I've learned along the way. I think it's very important to say that, you know, Dick Williams was part of my growth as a professional athlete.
Reg, you mentioned Billy Martin in one of the most famous, all-time famous videos. You're coming into the dugout. You threw your helmet down. Billy Martin's hopping up and down like a little league shortstop, and I don't think you could have got a piece of paper between you and him. What kind of guy, positive and negative, management style now? I'm trying to relate back to the management capabilities. You had a different opinion of Billy. Share that with us.
That was in Boston. It was during the season. It was in June. It was 1977. I was struggling to adjust to New York and to the Yankees. I did not have a helmet on. I had on a hat, a cap, and a pair of glasses, and I took my glasses off. Billy Martin had said to me, if you're going to embarrass this team, I'm going to embarrass you. My comment to him, I was probably 2 or 3 inches from him because I didn't know he was upset. I couldn't imagine. And my comment to him was that alcohol you've been drinking must be going to your brain because it's affecting your decision making. You know, we had words, and while we had words, he walked down to the other end of the dugout, and people got between us, and really, thank goodness, nothing did happen. I had a very close friend by the name of Fran Healy who came in from the bullpen and talked me into getting dressed and going home.
Were there any positives you ever got out of Billy?
He was a fighter, you know, a guy who didn't come from much and made something out of him. He was a very good baseball man.
Reg, there are people out there in corporate America that you're coaching now. How do you help them deal with an oppressive management style? How can they overcome that the way you did?
I believe in hard work. I believe in fairness. I have a belief that the company is owed more than the company owes me. Most everywhere I've been, the company has always existed before I got there. And if they paid me $10 a day or $10 million a day, that company should get more than I. It should get a dividend on what it pays me. And for the person that pays the bills and guarantees those bills, that person should get something out of what I contribute. And I believe that, and I believe that as a professional approach. I've always believed in that, and I learned that from my father.
Reg, give us some thoughts about Thurman Munson. Was he as great as, I mean, the feeling that people had about him?
Thurman was a gritty player. He was a very efficient player. He was a great professional. He would be the type of player that you'd want on your club because he was a great offensive player. He probably had the best bat control of any player I could ever played with. I had better communication with him as an offensive player than I did with anybody else because he could do so much with the bat. Thurman was an enormously sensitive guy that sometimes felt that he wasn't appreciated by people, by the organization. So he got down quite a bit. You know, he needed the things that all of us need, really, which is support, pats on the back, and really anything that says I care.
Did he have a huge heart?
He had a big heart in a couple of ways. He had a big heart as far as what you could expect from him. He had a big heart as far as what he could reach for and give as a player, same as a person. And he was sensitive, although he hit it well. You know, he wore a shield and he wore a callous shield, but he really wasn't. He wore that tough protective shield because he was so soft inside.
Kind of like Reggie Jackson, huh?
I don't know about that.
I see a smile there, so I know we touched a nerve.
In this portion of the Winner's Edge, Ray's gone one-on-one with Reggie, and they discussed the early years and the impact of family, especially Reggie's dad, on his upbringing and his values. Ray and Reg then went on to discuss the coaches in Reggie's life, both good and bad. How about the coaches in your life? How about the coach you've been in the lives of family and business team members? Reggie went on to discuss the benevolence and genius of Charlie Finley as an entrepreneur and visionary in the 20th century. The Oakland A's is the ultimate in team and team effort, discipline, drive, desire, and we're only halfway through this edition of The Winner's Edge with Ray Pelletier. So please, forward to the end and continue on with Ray and Reggie, going one-on-one to capture The Winner's Edge.
Becomes the second man in World Series history to hit three home runs in a game. We told you earlier, Babe Ruth did it on two occasions, in 1926 and in 1928. And Jackson just crunched one over the center field wall. That must have been 440 feet or more away. And they want Jackson to come out and take a bow with the Yankees leading 8-3 in the eighth inning.
I've never seen the sun shine brighter, and the morning never felt so good against my face. I feel just like a young child skipping down a country road, or like a well-tuned engine that's fueled up and geared up and ready to win this race. Stop.